unexpected in music is the thing that turns us on, I think. And the biggest surprises happen sometimes in the most familiar pieces. If you listen to whatever favorite song and all of a sudden you hear this one thing, that's the thing that inspires.
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, Ronald Young Jr.
And I am your other host, Isaac Butler.
Isaac Butler.
Ronald Young Jr.
It's good to be back with you again.
Yeah.
Whose voice was that we hear at the top of the show?
So that was the clarinetist Anthony McGill. He is the principal clarinetist with the New York Philharmonic. And I think it's probably worth mentioning, he is the first African-American principal musician in that organization's history.
You know, that's all I needed to hear. That is the type of news that I am here for. Why did you want to talk to Anthony right now?
Well, we don't actually talk about that aspect of his career at all because, you know, this is a creativity and craft focused thing, you know, but I really wanted to talk to Anthony because we just haven't had a lot of classical musicians on the show. Honestly, we've had a lot of jazz musicians, we've had opera singers, we've had composers, but I felt like this was a field we were really missing, the kind of purely interpretational field. Right. And I've always been really curious about, like, there's what I think of as almost like a straitjacket of, like, the sheet music is written and the conductor's interpretation and everything. So I've always wanted to ask, like, what part of your job do you actually see as creative, you know?
That's awesome. And I'm very much looking forward to this conversation. But I'm assuming that you have something special for our Slate Plus members. What can they expect?
So for Slate Plus, Anthony and I discuss his major influences and heroes and what it was like to meet those folks and get to know them and everything like that. And then also there's this whole other half of his career, which is that he is a touring freelance soloist for hire. So, like, when your orchestra is doing one of the major clarinet concertos, you would hire him to come in and be the soloist in that. And that's just such a weird world. I really wanted to know more about it.
I'm looking forward to all of this interview, but if you are a member of Slate Plus, you'll get to hear all of the interview plus the part that Isaac just said. And if you aren't, it's really easy to join. As a Slate Plus member, you get to hear extra segments on this show and others like the Culture Gap Fest and Care and Feeding, the parenting podcast formerly known as Mom and Dad Are Fighting. You'll also get bonus episodes of podcasts like the Emmy-winning Slow Burn. And of course, you'll never hit a paywall on Slate.com. To learn more, go to Slate.com/workingplus. All right, let's hear Isaac Butler's conversation with Anthony McGill.
Anthony McGill, thank you for joining us this week on Working to talk all things the creative process.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So you wear a lot of different hats in your creative life, but I wanted to ask really specifically about one of them, sort of what I sense is your main gig as the principal clarinet of the New York Philharmonic. Can you just explain what that actually means? Because I have a feeling a bunch of our listeners, you know, they'll see in the program principal this, principal that, and be like, well, what the heck is that?
Yeah. The job basically is, a symphony orchestra is a group of about 100 people. But in the clarinet section, specifically in a major orchestra, there are basically only 4 positions of permanent musicians that play clarinet in that orchestra. And the principal clarinetist is like the first chair of the orchestra, the first chair, or sometimes called the solo clarinet of the orchestra. So I get to play the clarinet solos that you might hear, you know, if you go to the symphony concert. And so along with my colleagues, we'll be playing the clarinet parts, but mine is specific to my, what we call chair in the orchestra. And so that's what the principal clarinetist does in a symphony orchestra.
Right. And that's a salaried position, right? That is you're an employee of the Philharmonic. Cause I know you do all sorts of other things, but in a odd sense, your day job is with the New York Philharmonic.
Yeah. I always say that's my day job and that's my night job too. So, right. In that job, we play about 4 concerts a week all year long maybe for 9-10 months. And then we tour during the summers. We go to Asia or Europe, Colorado, you know, States tours as well.
And how many new pieces, by which I don't mean newly composed pieces, but just pieces being added to the repertoire you're doing in a given year, usually?
Yeah, we basically play 3 or 4 new pieces every single week.
Oh my God.
So every time you go to the symphony, you're pretty much hearing, if you go every week to the symphony, you're going to hear a different program.
Got it. Got it. And so can I just ask what drew you to the clarinet? Because I know you've been playing it since you were a kid and, you know, when other people are picking up an electric guitar or whatever. Or in my case, piano. I was not cool. My case is piano. But yeah, what drew you to the clarinet?
Well, that's kind of funny. It's a funny story. Speaking of cool, I wanted to play saxophone, which is
right. Kind
of a cool instrument.
The coolest.
The
probably,
coolest
right?
instrument. That was my first choice. And I was in like 4th grade, right? Mm. And I went into this band room and there were all these instruments on the table and I went straight for the saxophone. It was probably an alto sax, and which is the medium-sized saxophone. And then I picked it up and the band teacher, they just started a band at this school. He looked at me and he said, I think you need to play the clarinet, because the saxophone was like way bigger than me. It was like
amazing.
It was like, he was like, okay, you're just going to play the clarinet and you're going to switch to the saxophone. And the rest is history. I just, played that thing and still do.
Amazing. And so what is your kind of, do you have a normal creative day? Like, is there a normal day for you in terms of what your schedule is like? You know, because you're gigging all over the country on top of what you're doing at the Philharmonic. So is it just pure chaos or?
Yeah, it's kind of pure chaos. Although, so there's some common themes, you know. So like an average day that I'm like at home in New York, it will involve the Philharmonic. And that's pretty standard. So that involves like going to a rehearsal at 10 o'clock every morning during the week. And then that's like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And then a dress rehearsal and then a concert on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, sometimes Sunday, and sometimes Tuesday. And
but in order to make that kind of schedule work, you have to come in with the piece already prepared, right? I mean, this is a part of the classical musician's life that I feel like a lot of people don't understand is, you know, I come from a theater background where, you rehearse for 4 weeks or something as a group. You don't come in with the role already known and interpreted and everything like that. So when you show up for one of those rehearsals, what is the expectation as to what you know how to do right off the bat?
In the kind of orchestra I play in, it's basically like it's go from the start. And so the expectation is that you're, I don't like to use this word ever, but you're like, I won't use it. Never mind. It was the P word called perfect.
Oh,
but
yeah.
No, it's the, I hate that word, but you're prepared to play the concert right away.
Right.
Because you know what the repertoire is like as soon as they release the season the year before. So you've already prepared all of your, all the preparation you could possibly do, you're supposed to have done it before that first rehearsal. And then the conductor's job, or they're like the director for the week. And it's a new conductor each week, generally. So with that new program, new director, you're coming in prepared with all of your lines, ready to go, all of the concepts that you think it should go like. And then the conductor comes in, and if there's stuff that's not quite together, they'll try to get that together. If it's not quite in tune, they'll try to get it in tune. If it's not quite musically their idea as an orchestra, they'll try to tell you what they think their idea is for that week's performances. And so you do that very, very, very quickly and intensely.
Wow. Now, do you feel like you've been playing with the Philharmonic for a while now, you know your colleagues and everything like that. Does that affect your interpretation in your preparation that you sort of probably know what the other musicians are going to be doing or what their sort of take on the material might be?
I think there's like a, in orchestral playing, symphonic playing, there's like a generally accepted style, tempo, interpretation that everyone will know, even though there are 100 recordings of these things that you've already kind of heard all of them or a lot of them or the different variations of. There's certain markings in the music that will tell you where you need to start from, that the composer has already written into that music. And it's like, you know, you're recreating a painting. You kind of know what the Mona Lisa looks like already. It's already been painted. So you kind of have an idea of how to recreate it. But then, obviously, there are personal touches that you put on it. So that's my job as a solo clarinetist, is to put my personal touches on the thing that's already been created in order to make it musical. The thing right. isn't musical on its own.
I'd love to talk a bit more about that, about where the individual expression in a through composed piece of music, like where it lives for you, you know?
Yeah. So I spoke of like all the direction that you get from a composer and that you can get from a conductor too. It's like the little things like, okay, it's at this tempo. It's in this beat per measure. These are the notes. And these are the dynamics, which are like how loud or soft you play things. All of those directions, a lot of those directions are all written and through composed, as you say. The thing that can't be prepared so much ahead of time by the composer is how you do those things, how passionately you play the things that are written on the page, how much they sound like they're not written down, how much they sound like they're coming from the heart and the spirit of the musician. And the quality of your sound is unique to you. That's actually the really, really, really important part of like this type of artistry and creation, is that I am the creator of my clarinet sound. And so through that voice, like a voice on the stage, a singer on the stage, that's where all of the creativity lies. It's like, it's not the what, it's the how. It's the spirit of the thing beneath the music. Just as if you're an actor, it's your voice. You know, the right. words have been written by Shakespeare or whoever, but it's actually you. And so how can I express me through this music that was written yesterday or like hundreds of years ago?
Right. And the older it is, the more it has accreted the bounds of acceptable interpretation, right?
Yeah. And
because there's a tradition then.
There is a tradition. And yeah, so the interesting piece comes in the discovery, piece of discovery, and where real artistry comes in is how do I take the fresh approach today to make this music touch the people that are in the audience right now? You're trying to communicate expression, deep expression, loud expression, soft expression, sensitive expression, angry expression, whatever it is. That's what you were doing.
That's wild. I mean, that really goes to what you said earlier about your heart and your spirit, you know, and putting them into the music. Are there techniques you have for doing that? Is there a way you sort of get yourself into the emotional space of the music you're playing as you practice? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, I think in the practice of the thing, there is the common philosophy that I have, which is that, so you do learn technique. You learn the basic fundamentals of the thing that you're trying to play. And hopefully around the same time, you have a kind of, sometimes you can take a historical kind of knowledge of the thing. You can take a philosophical vision. You can even have imagery in your head, creative, you know, an image of like where this music exists emotionally for you. And you can try to imagine maybe where it emotionally existed for the composer. Use all of those things, mix them together, practice it for hours and hours and hours, et cetera, et cetera. And then in the performance, what I think is actually a little bit more complex is this process of performing as just a first person and then listening as well at the same time. And that's where the balance comes in of performing, but also in enjoyment or pain or sadness. And when those meet, that's when performance becomes almost overwhelming emotionally. And I had one of those recently, and we can talk about that later if you want.
I mean, we could talk about that now. I'm very curious about this. I mean, you know, I'm just curious about this because, you know, actors talk about this, musicians talk about this, athletes talk about this moment of the flow state, right? Which I think is kind of what you're talking about, where it's like you're not thinking about yourself anymore. You're sort of in the, if it's tennis, the tennis match, if it's acting, the monologue, or, you know, hear the piece of music, it's like you're in it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm just very curious about what your experience of that is like. I mean, it's one of the most difficult things to describe, but, yeah. You know, what is that like for you?
Yeah. So it's easy to do, and it's easy to describe when you're on the stage. I recently had a performance where I was on the stage in a piece. The piece is an hour-long piece by Olivier Messiaen, and it's called The Quartet for the End of Time. So it's pretty deep work.
One of the most beautiful, heartbreaking pieces of music composed in response, or, you know, to the World War II and the Holocaust and all sorts of other things. I mean, incredible work of 20th century music, yeah.
Yeah, Messiaen was a prisoner in a work camp and wrote this piece, you know, with these instruments, four instruments, clarinet, violin, piano, and cello. And one of the reasons why I was able to have like this uplifted experience was that I don't play for two of the movements. Like, everybody sits while other people play in a couple of the movements. He wrote a solo violin, violin and piano movement, and a cello and piano movement. And I was able to be emotionally taken away completely while my colleagues were playing this music. Those are the most inspiring moments, is when you're not in the act of playing, but you become a listener in your own performance. And even while you're playing, if you develop your technique so the technique isn't the thing that is the focus while you're doing it, only then can you also become a listener while you're playing. It's very similar, and this will be very familiar to a lot of listeners, I think, is when you're reading a book, like if you're into reading and you're really into the book, but at the beginning of the book, you might just be looking at the words and kind of trying to figure out the story. But somewhere in the middle of the book or toward the end, when you're really into that book that you just can't put down, you forget that you're in the act of reading, and the images and the characters and everything are just a part of your brain. And they're part of you, like you're in the story.
Yeah.
You forget about you sitting there at the table. You're not mindful of the presence of yourself anymore. You're just in the act of reading, but in its finest form, not like scrolling on the phone, looking at a headline, but in the, like where the scene takes over your brain, it takes over your body, and you lose your self-consciousness for a brief moment, or maybe an hour, or maybe 5 minutes. But whatever that moment is, that's the moment you're like, oh man, I love this book. You guys, you have to read this book, because you lost yourself in it for a moment.
Totally.
We'll be right back with more of Isaac Butler's conversation with Anthony McGill. Listeners, we want to hear from you. Every other Thursday on Working Overtime, we offer advice on how to get creative work done. So please tell us your challenges and let us help you. Drop us a line at working@slate.com. You can also send a voice memo to that address or give us a ring at 304-933-WORK. And if you're enjoying this episode, don't forget to subscribe to Working wherever you get your podcasts. Now let's return to Isaac Butler's conversation with Anthony McGill.
I read that meditation is a very important part of your practice.
Yes.
Can you talk about your meditation practice a little bit and how you see it as part of your creativity?
Yeah, sure. I only discovered meditation maybe 5-6 years ago. Maybe it was before the pandemic. I was introduced to this book called 10% Happier by Dan Harris. And he was a reporter for ABC. You can, you know, Google him. And I read it very quickly, and I was like, ah, oh, that's really interesting. I want to try this. And so the attention to the breath is the thing that I think is the most impactful for my music making and just for my, you know, presence on stage, thinking about how meditation, but even meditation sometimes comes with like a negative connotation for some people. So I would call it, for this explanation, for my own personal journey into meditation, I would call it breathing and thinking about your presence. And that really fascinates me. When I meditate, I'm talking about like for 5 minutes or 10 minutes. The most interesting thing I think about that, even if I set a timer and I listen to a guided meditation, is that those 10 minutes can feel like an hour.
Right.
Because I'm present here instead of like the thing about like the anxious world and the anxious life of a performer or a musician or just a human is that I don't have to necessarily think about the future. Mm-hmm. As I told a student recently, if you're really like actually present right here, there's just not a problem right here. There's a problem like there in a second, in the future, the second in the future, or the seconds that passed. But like right at this very moment, if we can grab that spot, I can't think of a problem.
Right. You've worked with, you know, you work with living composers. You also work, you know, very deeply in the repertoire. And I'm interested in those, the differences between those processes, right? Because I assume, you know, like is when you're working with a dead composer, you know, like Messiaen on Quartet of the End of Time or whatever, or do you do a lot of research? Is that part of your process?
I don't do a ton of research, Isaac. I would love to tell you I did. Some of it I learned, of course, over the years of my life, right. You know, so I know things about the composers, but I'm not one that dives into too deeply into theory or history, actually. But I like it. Like, yeah, with the living composers, it's great if there's like a personal connection and I know stuff, things right. about them, and I can dive into that and feel that, and they can kind of maybe know things about me that help me communicate better, which is great. But for the composers that aren't alive, I think it's more of a personal journey into somehow getting to know them through the sounds of their music and the directions that they've given me on the page. And so that's how I work with that. And so I don't really do historical practice things, but it's good to know about them. And sometimes I will, you know, if it feeds into what I think might be a good idea in the present.
Right, because there is that whole school of kind of trying to get back to as close to what it may have sounded like in 1753 or whatever when someone wrote that piece of music, it sounds like is not your bag.
It can be a little problematic, I will say. Mm. I think if you're into that, do it for your own personal gratification, if that's what you are, you're into that practice. But I don't like it when, for instance, if we want to go here, I don't like it when people from a certain country think that you can only play that music if you're from that country, for instance.
Oh, yeah, totally. That kind of essentialism.
Oh, goodness.
You must have a German soul.
Oh, my goodness.
Anthony, you must Isaac, have a German soul to play.
Isaac, don't get me going on that.
Yeah. Well, and part of the point of performance is to bring the piece of music back to life. You could always listen to a recording if
yes.
that's what you care about, right?
Yes, yeah.
You also have a recent project that you've put together called American Stories, which, you know, folks can listen to in the streaming service of their choice or preferably buy in physical media form. Can you talk a bit about how that developed? Did you commission the pieces that are in it or...
Yeah, a couple of the pieces were written already and hadn't been recorded or performed very often, if that. The composers are all living. And it just kind of came together organically through working on one or two of the pieces with the Pacifica Quartet. They're an amazing string quartet that are some of my main collaborators. They're a Grammy-winning quartet. And we were just nominated for a Grammy this year for this album. And every piece is so different. Every piece has its own story behind it. And every composer also has a unique voice and story to tell. So we put these all on one album to explore those connections, but also the beauty in the diversity of all of the works, all of the composers, and all of their different stories under the umbrella of what American composition may look like right now in living composers. And so it's like a beautiful accident, to be honest, that we were able to put all of these onto this same physical CD. And I think important, I could go into this for a really long time, but I think important, if there's a way to find, probably on the Sadie Records produced this or distributed it. It's a beautiful small label out of Chicago. And if you can go to their website and read the program notes for this album, it's pretty powerful, the stuff that's on there. And some of the music is dedicated to really serious, tragic things and interesting explorations of personhood and identity and character and biography, you know, of the different people. So I could spend an hour just talking about that. But.
Well, I did want to talk a little bit about that specific subject. I mean, that's really deeply embedded in the pieces themselves. One of them is about the 1963 Birmingham church bombing, right? There's another piece that's about homelessness in Los Angeles, for just to give two examples of some American stories that it's about. How do you feel the presence of that subject matter in the music itself, right? Because there's a certain... Mm-hmm. Abstractions may be the wrong word, but you know what I mean. Ineffable quality to music, because there's no language, there's no images, right? It's notes, it's melody, it's harmony. And so I'm curious about how you see that themes as existing in the music, and as you put it, you know, in your heart and spirit as you're playing it.
Yeah, I think I wanted to examine as a musician personally, I wanted to examine those different philosophies, if you will, thinking about music for music's sake, which I'm like a believer in, like just the beauty or not of sound in space, how one can enjoy music just with that alone, or experience music with just that, just the sound. Put the thing on, or go to the concert. Don't read anything and just listen. That is a wonderful way to experience music. No denying it. But sometimes it does help to know who wrote the thing. What is their story? Why did they write the piece of music? Why did they create this work? Did they dedicate it to someone? Who were those people? Is there pain in the music? What is that pain about? How do I express that in the sound? As a listener, you can do this without knowing anything about it. You can say, and that's a great exploration too. You can listen to a piece and then read about it after, or you can read about a piece and then hear it after. I'd like to know that there's some relationship there that might enrich the listening experience, or might even just enrich our lives as people, because I think art can do that. I think sometimes separating things out doesn't necessarily help. For instance, if you were to go into like a museum and stand in front of a piece of art and just experience it, I'm sure there are people that are like, I don't want to read the little thing that's on the side of the art to explain it to me. But you know what?
My grandmother hated audio tours. Yeah. She was like, get that shit out of my ears. I do not want an audio tour.
Right.
Whereas I'm sure, like, audio tours. Yeah, that's great. Give me more information.
I know there are people that hate that stuff. Yeah. Even subtitles or supertitles at opera performances. It's like right. opera was based on like people going in and like, I don't care if you don't understand what they're saying. We're not going to put these things underneath so you can understand it in your language. I come along the lines of, like, sometimes it's good for art to be communicated in a way that can be, even for a moment, understood, mm-hmm. even though art doesn't need to be understood. So that's where it's like, I don't care. And yet, if, like, Michael Parloff, who presented this concert, he gave like a 10-minute, 15-minute talk about Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time before this hour-long work. And he does it in such a way that's inspiring and beautiful. And it can take you into the place where maybe you will, for the first time hearing this piece, be moved from it. If not moved from it, you might understand where are the places you were challenged by the music and why. And that's good to me. I think that is like a good thing for an art form that can be seen as inaccessible if it doesn't just sound like a simple melody. And if that helps, for instance, it's subjective, of course, it's art, but I like to be able to look at a painting and try to discover something and then look at the little card on the side and say,
right.
Oh, shoot, I missed the whole point, the story. But look at that little eagle in the middle that I didn't spot. Or like my daughter will say, oh, yeah, I see that. Do you see that cat in the background? And I was like, no, I didn't see that cat. But that's why this painting is called Cat. You know, like I didn't see the cat in the painting right. at all. But somebody else did. And that kind of exploration, I think, can bring a lot of pleasure. And that's what I was trying to do with this, with the American Stories, is not just bring pleasure, but bring a thoughtfulness to a work of music, an album of music, like a work of art. There's a lot to discover, an experience that is in addition to the sound.
Right. That's a great answer. You're at a point, you know, I can't imagine how many times you've played, just for example, Debussy's clarinet concerto, right? Because that's, you know, one of the major pieces of your rep. How do you get re-inspired with something you've played a million times before?
Yeah. Of course, I do that all the time. I play pieces I've played many times before. But I'll tell you, because I just had this experience on Sunday again, is that I don't need to try. I don't need to try. Sometimes most of the time, if I just listen, if I'm open to the experience as it's happening, the pieces are just beautiful. And so if I'm just there for it, I don't care if it's the 100th time, you know, whether it's like the Brahms Clarinet Quintet or Messiaen, whatever it is, I will be able to hear beauty or interesting things in places I've never heard them before. Hmm. The surprise in music, the unexpected in music, is the thing that turns us on, I think. And the biggest surprises happen sometimes in the most familiar pieces, because I think I know it. You think you know it, but if you listen to whatever favorite song that you like, and all of a sudden you've heard it for 30 years and you hear this one thing, whether it's in a bass line or a cello line or whatever it is, a singer singing this one thing or a little shake of the voice you never heard before, that's the thing that inspires. That's the thing that can move you, because you did. It was unexpected. You're like, I've heard this so many times. It's like, how have I never heard that? Have I never heard that? But in a way, with music, every time you hear something or play something, you're hearing it or playing it for the very first time at that moment. You've never been in that space before. You've never been who you are at 1:59 on a Tuesday listening to that thing or playing that performance. That has never happened before. You know, when you can experience that and kind of get into it, that's the thing that is moving. That's the thing that's inspiring, is that, oh, shoot, this, of course, this, I've been doing this every single day so long, but this is the first time I've heard it. You know, this is the first time I've really been here for it. And I think that's like what makes great listening and great performances.
Anthony McGill, thank you so much for joining us to talk about your process here on Working.
Thanks so much.
Up next, Isaac and I will talk more about the interpretations into performance of music and preparation for professionals and ensembles. Stick around for that. All right, Isaac, this was an interesting one for me. I grew up surrounded by a lot of music. I sang in the choir at church. I did percussion all throughout high school. I am very familiar with orchestral sound, and I'm always intrigued by people who continue to do this type of organized playing well beyond the high school and even collegiate level. If you're making a living playing this type of music, you have to be very good at it. So I really respect folks who stick with it for this long. Tell me, what is your relationship with playing music? Do you have a musical instrument history or any hidden playing talents? You might have already talked about them on the show, but I'm new. Make me hip.
Yeah, well, first of all, can I ask percussion? So which instruments?
Oh, my God, man. All of them.
Yeah?
I ended up as drum captain, so I played quads my last 2 years. Actually, my last 3 years. I only played snare 1 year. So I got pretty good at the four drums, quads.
Amazing, amazing. So I grew up playing piano. You know, like, I'm of that generation where it's like, you're middle class. Your parents want you to be educated. Here's a piano, kid. Do you know what I mean? I mean, my dad played a bunch of instruments. My dad played guitar, piano, saxophone, and bassoon. Ooh. So I grew up playing piano, but in third grade, I met my best friend, David Hamlin, and he was so much better than I was already. Like, he was already one of those kids where, like, he heard a song on the radio and then could sit down and just play it on the piano. Mm-hmm. Like, he was like that, like a genius. And I just knew I was never going to be as good as him. And so I just sort of like lost the drive a bit, but I kept doing it until seventh grade. And in seventh grade, I switched to playing the drums.
Good choice.
And I did drums and percussion, little vibraphone, you know, little occasional wood block, maybe sometimes a ding, da, da, ding, da,
they
da, ding
need
of
it,
a triangle.
It's important. It's seasoning. Yes.
It's seasoning. Yeah. So I did that through high school. And then my freshman year at Vassar, a band called Skaba the Hut stole my drum set. And I took that as a sign from God that I should stop playing the drums. Wow. And so now, like, I play the ukulele. I have an old keyboard, like an old Cassiotone lying around that I doodle around. I sing all the time, much to my daughter's annoyance. And actually, Dave, who I am hanging out with when he's in town this weekend, still one of my closest friends, and he's an opera composer and conductor.
That's incredible. Like, you really, I love how there was also the reverse tale of Dave Hamlin that you just, you gave us a back introduction. I really like that. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So when Anthony was talking about the interpretation of a musical piece, I remember thinking right before he said it, that it is exactly like an actor playing a role in a play. Like, they have to interpret it and put their own spin on it. It never occurred to me that that is the part of what makes each performance of music unique every time an audience hears it.
Yeah.
It makes me appreciate the art of sampling and mixing and mashups and strengthens the idea of creating something new by standing on something familiar. What did you think about that part, Isaac?
Totally. You know, in both acting and classical music, you kind of confront the problem of spontaneity. How do you make this thing that you have done 1,000 times over feel new and embodied and alive in this kind of profound way, while it is also technically exact to whatever the specifications of the performance are, right? You know, in music, it's the notes in the sheet music, the dynamics, what the conductors told you to do. In theater, it's the script, the blocking, the lights, your scene partner. This is just one of the major struggles of both art forms, and also part of what to me is sort of the inherent beautiful, you know, deeply meaningful poetry of them is that very thing. And it's also, to me, what usually sets apart good to great artists from just okay artists, right? The just okay artists, like, they can do it. You can do it. But, like, the good to great artist is able to do it in such a way that it feels like they're just doing it for the first time, but perfectly. And it's almost like a magic trick. It takes a lot of training and, I think, some natural talent to be able to do it. But it's really incredible when you see it happen.
Yeah, yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Another part that was surprising to me, and it's probably, again, because the highest level of band I did was in high school, was that these professional musicians are expected to have the music worked out before they get to rehearsal. You want to talk about being geniuses and savants in this case. Mm-hmm. Can you talk more about how this compares to acting? Are actors showing up ready to go, or is there more workshopping before we get to the real rehearsals?
Oh, you know, that's a great question, because actually my second book is a lot about this, the method, because actually it's one of the major changes in acting is around this. So in the early to mid 19th century in most European nations and in Russia, there's not enough of an audience to fill a long run of a play. So you're doing plays in repertory with one another. So you're premiering like a new play every week, and then you're rotating that with other works in the repertory throughout the year. And then you bring back a production from a couple years ago or whatever, though, kind of the way classical music or the opera world works today. And so to make that work, you know, in Russia, for example, the most rehearsals a play would have is 9. Okay, so you would work out the role on your own. You would memorize the lines on your own. You would interpret the work on your own. And then over the course of a handful of rehearsals, the whole thing would be kind of thrown together. A whole lot of things happen that make that model obsolete, which I talk about in the book. But what replaces that model is the important thing, which is the one we have today, where rehearsals go for a few weeks, or in some European countries, months. Actors, you might come to your first rehearsal with the lines learned. You might not. Not depending on the actor and the director's expectation, but you definitely do not have the interpretation set. There's a person called the director whose job it is to marshal that production. That job's invented basically in the mid 19th century. You know, it used to be a lot more like symphony orchestras. And I have seen a friend of mine has a jazz big band, and the music that he composes for them is incredibly complicated. And I have watched them rehearse, and it's really fascinating because, you know, at the first rehearsal, all of them have only been playing by themselves. They know it all by heart. They know how to do it, but they've got to integrate it into like an 18-person ensemble. It's a really fascinating thing to watch happen.
You know, I'm always impressed by these little tidbits that you give about your very interesting life. Like one of them that you just get to drop in on a big band rehearsal. Like I was like, yo, I would love to be doing that in my free time. Yeah. Like, hey, my friends are in a band. I'm going to go see what they're doing over there.
In this particular case, we were working on a show together. And so it was the music for that show that I was watching. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's cool. If you get a chance to watch people in creative professions do their job, if you get a chance to sit in on it and just observe, like absolutely. A piece of advice I would give to anyone is just like, always say yes to that. You know, someone's like, oh, I'm rehearsing this thing, come see it. You know what I mean? It's like, you just learn so much. It's wild.
I'm going to take that as a personal challenge and try to like get in on more of my creative friends, especially in their works in progress.
Yeah, totally.
All right. So one last one for the road. I know you're kind of, you have a handful of instruments that you actually play. Are there any instruments that you would want to learn? What is that?
It's a cigar box ukulele I got from a Kickstarter, and it looks really beautiful, but actually the fretboard is wrong, and so it doesn't actually play the correct notes, and so I actually have to get it repaired, so it's just hung up on my wall. So you got
I love it. Listeners, it's a square ukulele. It actually looks like a cigar box. It's incredible. But yeah, if you could pick another instrument to play, what would you want to play? What else would you want to play, I should say?
Well, part of it is like, I wish I was good at piano again or keyboards or whatever, which I used to play, and like I can play chords or whatever. But I see you got one behind you there. I'm going to say bass. The couple times I've like been at a friend's house and there's been a bass lying around and I picked it up, I'm like, this is actually really fun. You know, it's just fun to just be like, do, 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 do. You know, like it's good times. What about you?
You know, I'm actually in that era. Like the keyboard that you see behind me is the instrument that I wanted to play. And I've been learning it since January 2020, pre-pandemic, just so everyone knows, pre-pandemic. But that's the instrument I've wanted to learn my entire life. And I'm like slowly doing a good job at it. And my goal is to be a really good 65-year-old keyboard player.
That's amazing. That's amazing. What style of piano are you learning?
Right now, it's just the classic stuff. I'm like, it's funny because I picked up a lot of stuff online. So I obviously want to learn how to play at my church and play the gospel tradition and all that. But I'm playing a lot of like classical stuff. Like I'm learning, I'm in Alfred's book and like everyone starts off, but now I'm like just kind of locking in the actual keys and trying to learn the same thing at every key so I can like really be more improvisational when I play with other people. So I'm excited.
That's awesome.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you have, remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Then you'll never miss an episode. And just a reminder that by joining Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like the Emmy-winning Slow Burn, and you'll never hit a paywall on the Slate site. So to learn more, go to slate.com/workingplus.
Thank you to our guest, Anthony McGill, and to our tuneful, soulful producer, Cameron Drews. We'll be back next week with Ronald Young Jr.'s conversation with Anna Sale. She is the host of Death, Sex, and Money, the legendary podcast, which has recently joined the Slate podcasting team. Until then, get back to work.